All right. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the September 24th meeting of the Kitsap County Planning Commission. As always, we will begin our agenda with introductions. My name is Kim Allen. I'm the chair, and I come from South Kitsap.
Joe Phillips, North Kitsap.
She's Central.
No.
Really? Okay.
Aaron Murphy, North Kitsap.
Rick Shattuck from Central Kitsap.
Amy Mall from North Kitsap.
Mike Elias in Central Kitsap.
Jim Swenson, South Kitsap.
And Gina Buskirk has informed us that she cannot make it tonight, so she will be absent. So moving on, we have on our agenda just one item tonight. Am I right? Okay. With that, I'll entertain a motion for adoption of the agenda.
I so move.
Second.
Any discussion or changes? All those in favor, raise your hand. All those opposed, raise your hand. Passes unanimously. Okay, moving on to approval of the minutes. We have a few corrections to the minutes. They're pretty much kind of clerical changes. I'll read them. I have a copy of them here, but some of the comments attributed to Amy in the minutes were actually supposed to be attributed to Aaron Murphy. Two different AMs. So what's that? Okay. They were attributed to Aaron, but they should be Amy's comments. So we have, on page 3, lines 35 through 37, Mr. Murphy notes that this shows recycling facilities grouped with fabrication and 35 manufacturing. Notes major differences between junkyards and recycling need to be 36 defined, such as what is being recycled and any different requirements based on those 37 definitions. On page 6, line 15, Mr. Murphy asks about progress on tiny homes, whether they're considered or permitted as mobile homes or another use. And on page 6, line 19, Mr. Murphy 19 asks about foundation requirements. So those would be the proposed corrections to the minutes. I do have a copy if anybody needs to see them in context before we vote. All right. Then I'll entertain a motion to adopt the minutes as revised by the changes I just read.
I'll make the motion to move approval of the minutes 9:17 as just read, amended.
Second.
Any other discussion or comments or additions or corrections? Hearing none, all those in favor, raise your hand high. All those opposed, raise your hand high. All those abstaining, raise your hand high. And we have six. Oh, you've got it, Amanda. Six in favor, one opposed.
And by the way, I listened to the tape, and the one thing I learned is get closer to the microphone. So I have empathy. Yep.
That's right. And just for the record, we did not have one opposed. We had one abstention.
Correct.
All right. So with that, we'll move on to general comment. This is the portion of our meeting where members of the public can have a few minutes to speak to the Planning Commission on items not on our agenda tonight. Do we have anyone who wishes to address the Planning Commission? Please come to the podium. Oh, good.
Genius.
Okay. Right here would be just fine. Please state your name and spell your last name for the record.
Hank Anderson. I live in Silverdale. Not realizing I'd have an opportunity, I didn't prepare much of a statement. I would like to go on what's obviously a record, though, being somewhat against the rezone request up there on Dickey to change from industrial to urban low. I think it's, first of all, poor location, and second, I don't see where it makes good sense in the long run to reduce the acreage potentially available for industrial type use in the Silverdale area. So,
just a point of clarification with staff, is this part of what we're dealing with on the
no.
This is not use table? Request.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just one. I guess it's the only site-specific rezone that's in the 2019.
Okay. And so, Mr. Anderson, I just want to let you know that this is a time that we have folks address us on items not on our agenda, but we do want to make it clear that this does not put you on the record for that item.
Okay, that's fine.
You'll still need to come back and make your comments in another way. But welcome, and we're glad
a slight chance I might sway you a little bit. Mm-hmm. Since you all are involved in the process.
Right.
Well, Thank you for your comments. Is there anything else?
No, that's it. Thank you.
Okay. All right, very good. Moving on to item E, work study zoning table update. We've got Liz Williams and Darren and Carmen and Dave Ward at the table. Take it away, Liz.
All right, sounds good. Thank you. So tonight is the last of our four work study sessions to kind of prep and prepare an initial draft proposal, which then we will be taking back out to the community, local stakeholders, to help refine this initial proposal. So very much still in the development phase of proposed changes, and just want to make sure that folks are clear on that. So this evening, really we're here just to kind of circle back on last week's discussion about the new uses that are being proposed, some of the uses that are being combined or split from each other, and then those that are no longer being proposed to remain as land uses within the table. We've also provided for you a summary of kind of a framework of proposed changes of how the use table will be reformatted, which we can walk through. And then we also wanted to provide you with a revised project schedule, which does take us out into June for formal adoption by the board. So just a little bit of a longer trajectory on this particular project. So we can walk through that. And then just a few questions from the for the commission about work study sessions once we get closer to that public process. So if there's no questions before we get started, I'll start by kind of walking through attachment one in your packet this evening, which is the summary of changes as of tonight. And we talked about quite a few of these at the last meeting, so I just wanted to kind of go back through and make sure we picked up all of the comments of the commission or anything new you might want to discuss. So I know Kim or Commissioner Allen at the last meeting brought up the definition of maker spaces and that it was, you know, skewed to more art type, you know, cooperative working spaces and wanting to see more of an emphasis on the shared office or shared work, more of an incubator type business. So we did go back and are proposing that that new use would be shared work / makerspace, and then have also integrated into the definition of that use some more references to different types of shared work facilities, commercial kitchens, to expand it beyond just the arts and craft type uses that were proposed in the initial definition.
Thank you.
We also talked briefly about wedding facilities and that was specific to wedding venues and wanting to broaden that definition out to event facilities. So that is one change that we've picked up as well in the proposal. Airport services, through further conversation and kind of feedback from the Planning Commission, we're proposing now to lump those airport services into one categorical use that would address the runways, taxiways, all the accessory buildings that may go with a airport use, in addition to the flight school, so the aviation school facility, training facilities for future pilots. We've integrated that into the definition of airports so that it's just one standalone use instead of three separate uses. We talked a little bit about the temporary new use of food trucks and wanting to broaden that out to mobile vending just in general. So there's been some slight adjustments to that definition to reflect more than just food truck vendors. So things like, help me out with, I'm trying to remember the definition, but we looked at things
mobile
like
mobile retail, yeah, establishments, mobile, yeah, pet grooming,
mm-hmm, those types of uses. Thank you. And then the transitory accommodations, there's a separate chapter in Title 17 that deals with transitory accommodations. The proposal would be to bring that those uses into the use table and then those development standards into the new framework of the categorical uses. So, and then I wanted to also talk about the recycling centers. I know we had some questions about lumping that with manufacturing and fabrication. Through further review, we did pull that out of that lumping and are going to have recycling centers as a standalone use. So any other questions about the new land uses that are being proposed?
Liz, can you please clarify on the recycling centers? Is that the processing facilities, or does that also include the drop-off locations, like the transfer station type dump stations?
It would include both. So it would include both the transfer stations and the actual processing of recycling materials.
So if that includes the drop-off stations, does that then limit the county's ability to, or the waste management's ability to place those things in neighborhood locations?
So I believe that those would fall, if it's a county-owned facility, I think it would fall under the public facilities heading, which then would not preclude it from being located in certain areas. So the county would have a different standard than perhaps a private transfer station that would develop in the county.
So if I understand your question, part of it is, how does this address the usual drop boxes for newspapers, clothing, whatever, that are pretty much located all around? Mm-hmm. Are we saying that those are needing permits now, or?
No, I think those would likely fall under the accessory use to an existing primary use. So if you're talking about like the donation centers,
right,
or, you know, that you see in parking lots of a lot of different retail establishments, those typically would fall under, you know, an accessory use to that particular land use. It wouldn't be a standalone.
Okay.
This would be on, you know, a recycling center that was on a parcel by itself that would be subject to these conditions.
Okay. Then I had a question. We're proposing to removing laundry mats and laundry services for personal services. And as much as I looked up personal services, I found it not very helpful on defining what it was going to cover. I think we're moving in a backwards position here. Unless you have something additional that fits under personal services, which then will have to be put in the definition, I see personal services as almost a misleading title.
Could you please read the current definition as we currently have it?
Sure. I would need Darren to pull it up here.
Or Darren. Anybody.
So that's the proposed definition for personal services as it reads. Sure. So personal services means an establishment providing frequent or recurrent needed services of a personal nature. Typical uses include, but are not limited to, barbershops, beauty salons and spas, personal laundry and dry cleaning, massage services, and pet grooming.
So does that include law offices, CPAs, physicians' offices?
No, those would fall under general office, the general office category.
See, and part of why I'm a little questioned on this is that your barbershops, beauty salons, spas, massage, and I do believe pet grooming are all licensed and require certain things, whereas a laundromat, laundry service, has no requirement other than business license.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of wondering how that got lumped into that.
Yeah, I think it was recognizing kind of the level of, you know, traffic in and out of such a use would be similar that you would see to a hair salon where you've got customers kind of going throughout the day. I think also just based on comparison of surrounding jurisdictions, that's where that's coming from as well. You know, and then obviously the desire to, you know, lump where possible rather than splitting out specific uses that could fall under a similar category to others. So that's really, I think, and unless you guys have anything else to add in terms of why that proposal is coming forward to lump that with personal service.
Is there a different way that we could potentially capture this type of service? I mean, I can see how this definition, given that kind of ambiguity, might be prone to scope creep. And if there's a better way to frame it, I think we'd certainly be open to capturing that a little bit better.
I have another environmental question about this one. Dry cleaners are really toxic. They can be very, very toxic. But I learned recently that, at least in Seattle, there are very few actual dry cleaners that dry clean on the premises. Mostly they send the cleaning out to, like, large facilities that collect all the dry cleaning. So that becomes almost like an industrial process, as opposed to the little neighborhood places that just take the dry cleaning in would definitely fall under this category.
Mm-hmm.
It might be too nitpicky to want to, you know, pull that apart, but I can imagine you really wouldn't want these, like, big collection dry cleaners in a, you know, mixed use kind of zone, but the little, like, collection dry cleaners would be really appropriate in those situations. So just something to think about.
Yeah. In my mind, I made a distinction between personal, with the adjective personal, meaning the smaller mom and pop, as opposed to commercial laundries, commercial dry cleaning facilities. But I think that, you know, we could wordsmith that to lock that down a little tighter. You're right.
From an environmental perspective, they do the cleaning on the premises, or do they send it off someplace else? Could be an issue in terms of whether you wanted it next to your house, sort of thing.
Yeah.
Well, also there's a tiny difference here of on a laundry or dry cleaning service, where that business is accepting an item from somebody and dealing with it and then returning it at a certain point. All the other, except for maybe pet grooming, you're pretty much there. You're receiving the personal service and then you're leaving. Mm-hmm. So there is kind of an ambiguity there of a laundry service being personal.
Sure.
I mean, I take a clock into the watch repair. That's not a personal service. That's a business.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of, that's what's gotten me a little bit when you say personal. The other items on that list all fit wonderfully. I guess some people would argue about the pet, but I think that fits well, but the dry cleaning laundry kind of, it doesn't really fit under personal services.
Okay.
I think part of what a lot of these are trying to get to are, what are those kind of repetitive services that people need to run their lives and take care of their bodies and presumably their pets' bodies and you know, and that people use on a recurring basis with some kind of frequency. You know, presumably you're going to get a haircut, you know, well, some of you are getting haircuts. you know, with a degree of frequency, as opposed to, you know, the getting a watch fixed, which you might do once every 10 years or so, or something like that. I think there's an element of that that we're trying to capture in this one. And,
well,
that, you know, how we best capture that is still kind of...
Right, and part of this is trying to make the code as clear and understood. So there isn't a, well, how did it wind up over here instead of over here?
Right.
You know, and that's kind of where I was going, personal services.
The other thing that came up.
To remove a laundromat was kind of like.
The other thing that came up in the staff discussion of this was that there are some types of businesses, even repair shops and things like that, that are kind of destinations. Where you only need to get a particular item fixed once every few years or so, and so you're willing to drive a little bit farther to go take it somewhere. Whereas there are some services that are just repetitive enough where you want them closer to home, and, you know, potentially even in your neighborhood or or close to your community. And maybe that's not an issue. Maybe we don't need to make that distinction.
Yeah, I guess I'm trying to look at it from what are the land use impacts, you know, the traffic impacts, you know, similar traffic patterns. You know, going into to do your laundry at a laundromat is pretty similar to, you know, getting a perm or, you know, any long type of, you know, a personal.
You can't spend a couple hours getting a perm.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So, I mean, you know, I don't see a huge difference between those types of services, But I think Amy's point's well taken. Yes. That mm-hmm. Let's make that distinction between commercial and the small mom and pop in the neighborhood drop off place a little bit different.
Okay. Yeah, I think it should say dry cleaning collection services.
Okay.
Whereas, and then somewhere in industrial,
yeah, we need
it
to clarify
make
that.
Reference to the full facility
right.
That does what they're shipped from that storefront to be done.
And I think that all makes sense, for sure.
Mike, did you have something?
Interesting discussion.
All right, anything else on this one?
I have a question.
Yep.
The way I'm reading page 2 of the summary of changes we received today, we're going from convalescent care facility, which I think of kind of nursing home, to hospital. Is what's the thinking behind that? I mean, I see the implications of hospital as being far more momentous in an area than a nursing home.
Right. So we had originally put convalescent care facility within the assisted or independent living facility. And at the last meeting, there was a discussion about the kind of more transient nature of a convalescent care facility. So folks are there for more of a temporary basis. And when we reviewed the definitions, the actual definition of hospital does already include convalescent care facilities. So, it was one that is already defined within another land use. So that's where the kind of logical combining of that would go. But to your point, you know, a hospital could be pretty large scale, where a convalescent facility may be a little smaller scale. So we would need to review the level of permissibility to make sure we're not, you know, excluding it from areas that it may be warranted.
So if somebody were to propose a nursing home with the capability of providing convalescent care, that wouldn't necessarily kick them into the hospital category? Or does it matter?
Not if it's an accessory use,
right,
to the primary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if they were operating an assisted living facility or independent care facility, and then they also provide that convalescent care as kind of a secondary business, you know, or use, then it would fall under the accessory use to that primary assisted living facility. Does that answer your question?
I think so. Yeah. It's my observation that most nursing homes do provide convalescent care,
right. Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of maybe incidental to,
yeah,
some of the other activities.
Yeah, and there's a facility in Silverdale, too, that does that. Three different tiers, and so you have multiple uses in the same footprint.
Mm-hmm.
Liz, can you refresh my memory, right, since we're on the topic of hospitals? How do we distinguish between hospitals and small clinics? Like even if it's a trauma center or something like that, it's not affiliated with a hospital.
Yeah.
So the presumption is that a hospital has overnight accommodations and a clinic does not.
Correct.
It's not based on necessarily on size.
No.
So clinic means a building or portion of a building containing offices for providing non-emergent chiropractic, medical, dental, or psychiatric services, not involving overnight housing of patients. And then, as Carmen indicated, the hospital does make the distinction that there are overnight patients.
Can you go back to that? And just under there, I was reading conference center. And so it means a building or a group of buildings with overnight accommodation. That usually the conference centers don't provide accommodations.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They're close to hotels and that, but they don't provide overnight accommodations,
right,
unless it's of an emergency nature.
And I think that'll be an important distinction to make since we're adding resort in, where I could see the resort providing both, you know, groupings of buildings and overnight accommodations,
right.
Yeah.
Conference complex,
yep,
would still have a separate building related to the sleeping overnight portion.
Typically. And it would have its set of requirements to meet.
Right.
Whereas if I set up a conference center, I'm not meeting the same requirements that a hotel would meet.
Potentially. I mean, mm-hmm, I would assume that you'd still have to meet, you know, your whatever health and safety, you know, those types of things. But
well, if I'm housing people overnight,
mm-hmm,
there's a whole set of requirements.
Sure.
Whereas if I'm housing a meeting.
Right. It's different.
That generally goes away at night. Mm-hmm. And that isn't the same requirements.
Right.
Aaron, did you have?
Yeah, if I could speak to the clinic definition again. Normally what the words we read together are medical, dental, vision, something like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
To throw chiropractic in it makes me go, well, where's PT and OT, physical therapy and occupational therapy? Like, it leads me in a different direction. Chiropractic seems like a weird thing to not assume it's under medical.
Mm-hmm.
So just if you're getting as specific as chiropractor, then I end up asking,
what's
physical therapy, mm-hmm, which seems weird.
Now maybe we need a categorization of the services as including but not limited to, which would.
Yeah, general medical, outpatient, whatever.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think your point on the vision would be a good one to add, though.
Thank you for helping us refine this.
This is exactly what we hoped you would be doing.
Exactly.
It's easy to walk in and play armchair.
Yeah. And did you pick up Commissioner Phillips' point on the comfort centers.
Like, yep, the overnight accommodations let's take a look at probably the should be stricken from that definition.
How do we, in where we are right now, how do we capture those conference facilities that are just providing meeting rooms but not lodging? Where do those land?
Would that be an event space?
Event center or event?
Yeah, well, once we add event center, it would probably fall under that. Where would we capture the overnight accommodations? Is that
no? Where would we capture the meeting rooms?
Like I think that would be clubs, social, or civic,
still conference center,
or still conference center. Yeah,
I think it would work in the conference center. Yeah. I think
just okay. When you threw the overnight accommodations in, that's what I went. Wait a minute.
I think where that came from was from facilities like the. What's the one in CBEC? Yeah, the CBEC Conference Center. And then we periodically get inquiries from people who are saying, well, what if we set up a conference center out on, in this rural area where people can have a retreat for their business and overnight and then that sort of thing? I think that's what we were trying to capture.
It's not uncommon also to hear the words conference and event center together.
Right.
So you may even look at how one or both of those aren't necessarily needed to be separated now that this isn't to include overnight.
Right.
Mm-hmm. When the dry cleaner convention comes to town.
We're in trouble.
Yep. Is it the dry cleaning collection convention or the
it's an important distinction for sure.
Well and to that point, I know Seattle has moved toward making it difficult to cite the actual on premises dry cleaners. I'd be interested what it's like over here in the county, if we have seen a similar shift. Because mm-hmm. If we're going to draw a distinction here, it should be relevant to what we have in terms of the structure of that particular business.
Historically, we have had dry cleaning facilities on site, even with what you might describe as mom and pop.
Right, and
most of those have been closed up and are now in remediation, environmental remediation. But and I think most mom and pops now have gone to the model that we're talking about, sending to a big.
And I think Dave's right with regard to how it fits into how often do you go and how quick are you in and out. And, for those of us that take shirts there, I don't know where they send them. I just know it takes me 5 minutes to drop them off, 5 minutes to pick them up, and then one closed. What did I do? I looked for the next closest one. Mm-hmm. So that made sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting point, though, on the environmental aspects of it. Thank you for bringing that up. Because, when you think about it, having that impact distributed across the landscape versus concentrating in one spot where it can potentially be contained is kind of an interesting thought.
Type of requirements for those facilities would be interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's right next to creosote.
So were there any other questions on page 2 of the combining uses? I think we talked about the contractor storage yard and the boat yard at last week's meeting, that those were going to come out as separate uses rather than lumping them in. Okay. All right. And then page 3 and 4, the changes there reflect scaling. So at the last meeting we talked about, is there really the need to break down research laboratory and food and beverage production to the extent that we were retail? So we migrated to the office scaling to be less split out.
Yep. Can we see the definition on research laboratory? I'm concerned about while we're addressing the size of the facility, a research facility that's analyzing data and such and putting that out, I have no issues with. It's understood what they're doing. A research facility that is doing chemical, biological, radiological research.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if we're, how that is dealt with in a code. How do we say somebody walks in and goes, I got a research facility, it's only going to be 5,000 square feet, and I want it in the place, and the county doesn't go, well, what research are you doing?
I could speak to that from the International Building Code perspective, which is that it comes up under the permitting of a shell building and its intended use, which could fall into up to four categories of hazardousness. So in my mind, research fits or doesn't fit in an area of plots of land inside the building, I feel like, is covered down the road.
Now, are we proposing a conditional use permit for all of these?
I believe it depends on which zone. So in the residential zones, it's not permitted,
right,
for any of them. And then if we scroll down to commercial. And you can see it is permitted in quite a few of the smaller scale, so 4,000 square feet or less would be permitted outright in most of the commercial zones.
How are they handled now?
It looks like right now they're prohibited in most of those zones, with the exception of the rural industrial. It was a conditional use permit. And that was no scaling. So regardless of size, the only zone it was conditionally allowed in would be rural industrial.
So it does seem like a bit of a leap, right, to go from completely prohibited to completely permitted.
Right.
Yeah. I'd like to see an A cup for maybe the smaller facilities and a full CUP for the largest ones. Might be a way to address that, even in the commercial areas.
Just to get it picked up early.
Just so that you can pick up Commissioner Phillips' concerns about what
research
type of research is being done. You know, are you splitting atoms next to my office? Or
right. Okay.
I agree. Yeah, that's
good.
I just said I agree.
Yeah, you read my mind on this. Back in the day, I used to do a lot of laboratory designs, and designing a lab that is processing, say, blood samples or water quality samples is a very different thing than one that's researching pharmaceutical powders or something like that. Mm-hmm. And you know, one could just be two or three people in a room with dissecting microscopes, picking out which insects are doing what. And it's pretty benign, and there's really not a lot of toxins there, but you know, you may have the 300,000 square foot laboratory that is doing something completely different. And so I think part of it is there's a question of scale, but there's also a wide variety
impact
of variation inside of them.
And I do believe the code also, you know, building code would dictate a lot of different requirements on what research you're doing.
It does a lot, and a lot of it is covered also by standards for particular industries where you're dealing with how you pressurize rooms and things like that and how you contain toxins.
Yeah, HVAC and all of that.
Just saying it's permitted doesn't mean, okay, now we don't have to meet fire code. It doesn't mean
right.
We don't have to meet the other things that would come into play depending on the kind of research you're doing. So one of the comments I wanted to make with this thing, I think it's a great job. We focused on the definitions, but I look at promoting uses and making the process easier. That's great. And so this may be the exception. I don't have a strong feeling about it, but if we can kind of my hope is let's keep this easier process, more open process for constituents. I think that's
I'm looking at, you know, people in the community wanting to, you know, at least have some sense of the whatever research is there, it's being accommodated, you know, in terms of an environmental review or you know, that type of thing, which you would need to have some sort of process for, as opposed to.
And Richard, I was riding right alongside you on horseback for most of this discussion, but this is one where it caught my attention, thanks to Joe and Kim, that, you know, gosh, it really does depend on what's happening inside, and maybe there should be one more step between completely prohibited, which clearly somebody had a pretty decent case there, for some period of time at length, and just to jump to permitted across the board doesn't feel right. I might push back a little on Ms. Allen and say, at least, you know, ACUP, so it doesn't become also financially and timeline, you know, unachievable.
Yeah, and the full CUP was only for the largest facility.
Right.
You know, that was my proposal, that an ACUP for all of them except for the largest category.
Right. And Liz, is it safe to assume, since if we were to scroll to the other larger research facilities, that those would have higher levels review the way it's written right now?
I believe so, but I would want to validate that here.
4 to 9.
It does look like the larger facilities would require the ACUP.
Except in what is that, industrial?
Yeah, the industrial zones.
That makes more sense. So if what could be happening inside is not reflected in any specific size, then I think I'd argue that what you've done correctly down below with the other two sizes is probably transferable.
Up to the top, yep. So hearing you, ACUP for the smaller scale. Yeah.
And any of them in the commercial zones?
What are the three that here in the 4 to 9 or 4 to 10 and 10 plus square footage range switched from P to ACUP? What land uses are those?
Sorry, what was that?
Oh, thank you. Okay, urban high, like a C and an RC. Okay, and then rural residential, industrial. Thank you. I was going to say that sounded weird. Okay.
Well, one thing to keep in mind on that, on this front, is that the urban high commercial also has pretty high residential density potential.
Right. Yeah.
Which might be a consideration if you're trying to locate potentially hazardous industries away from where people are living.
I in that case, I would argue that an ACUP, you know, it's not a full-blown, but at least it does address the questions that are going to come up.
And there is some notice for public comment in the ACUP process. So.
Right.
There is notice to the surroundings, but it's not as onerous and expensive a process as the full CUP. So yeah, I would concur.
Correct.
With that.
Balance.
So I think that gets us through the summary of changes documents, unless there's anything else the group wants to hit on with that. Not seeing anyone fighting. Well,
I just had one question that's come up several times in my practice, are people wanting to locate data centers in outside of the urban growth areas. I don't know, where would a data center fit? Any thoughts on that?
Good question.
Yeah, so again, I know we've had at least two groups that were looking for siding. They didn't pull the trigger on it, but they were looking for siding, and I don't think we've addressed major data centers anywhere in the code.
That's a good point.
It is a good point.
I think my immediate gut reaction would be to lump it in with professional offices, as far as zoning and impact and things
like that. Or would that be more of a warehouse?
Yeah, they're typically big warehouse type operations.
It could be. I've seen them go both ways. Yeah, if you have like a call center, that's a much more intensive use, more intensive than most offices is. Yeah.
Well, that's what it looked to me like. There was a hole in the code in terms of do we really want a major call center?
Or if it's a server farm.
That was what I was just thinking.
Then it's you know probably more suited to industrial. Sorry,
I actually do air emissions permitting and noise work for data centers. That's probably half of my job. So I can speak a little bit to the impact of data centers in neighborhoods. They tend to have pretty low employment. It doesn't take very many people to run them, so there's not a lot of traffic in and out. But they have these emergency generators that they test really frequently, and they're massive. In Eastern Washington, they actually require like really significant air permitting, not so much in the Puget Sound area, but they are very loud. They have massive air conditioning units all across the roof. They have a pretty big impact on the neighbors. I've done a lot of noise studies, property line noise studies, and it's a pretty big impact. So I would say that it seems that industrial areas are the best fit for them. The commercial area could be okay if it was a smaller data center or if they had less requirements for emergency generators for backup power, but otherwise pretty industrial.
Yeah, server farms, same thing. They generate a ton of heat. They have a lot of HVAC and cooling issues, and also the need for backup generators for continuity and of service and that kind of thing.
The only reason they're in business is because they don't go down, right? I mean, that is like the promise that they make to get hired. So
very different from a call center, which would be people, lots and lots of people coming and going, but not a lot of emissions or anything.
And I would also point out that on the data centers, you're also looking at a very high use of electricity.
Yeah.
So the power requirements to the facility are going to be substantial. So I think that would exclude it from a residential or rural area, unless you're right there next to a major power line.
Yeah. You might even think about where are our rural industrial. And does that even make sense?
The use there?
Yeah.
Yeah, we do help a lot of data center companies permit facilities in rural areas, but they generally get a zoning change to industrial. So.
Is there are there similar impacts or a distinction between something like a data processing center or a call center as opposed to a data storage center?
A good distinction. I think the impacts are different. I think data storage is, really what Aaron was just talking about, a big draw of electricity, heat, continuity, generators, that sort of thing. As a call center, I don't see I agree. Lots of people coming and going, and many shifts of cars coming in and out, but not the same need for the heavy duty.
Yeah, more of an office type.
Yeah, it is more akin to office, I think.
The specific uses, I think there were people looking for Bitcoin mining. And so they were looking for locations in rural Kitsap to do that. So I just didn't seem like we had looked at that.
Right.
So maybe we pick up both of those and the definitions and split them apart so that way it's crystal clear what type of a facility we're dealing with, at least as crystal clear as we can predict.
Yeah, because a call center, I would think, would be typically looking to locate near transit, which would be more commercial type areas for the workers to get in and out.
Right.
If we are a little low on agenda items, which means we have a little time, I'd actually ask Mr. Shattuck if there are any other uses just based on the industry that you're in that you have heard since your stance is in general, being economic development viable here for growth and letting, is there anything else that you're hearing of that you haven't seen.
Actually, that was really the only one. I looked at the use table and said, the question was asked to me, and I said, I don't know. And then, of course, people said, well, I don't want to ask DC. I don't want the answer from DCD. that was just, that's really the only hole I saw. That.
Thank you.
Yeah, we can explore that and see where other jurisdictions, how they define it, and you know.
You might look to Eastern Washington.
Yeah, it sounds like they're Quincy.
And once we, you know, take this outside of this group and take it into the broader public process, we'll hear from other people on this too, mm-hmm. on all of these.
Yeah.
This is just the starting point.
It's smart of you to admit it.
It is.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to move on to attachment 2, if there's no objections from the group here. So this is essentially the proposed framework for use tables and the footnotes. So we haven't really talked a lot about the footnotes yet and kind of how they're going to migrate and be repositioned within our code framework. So just to walk you through this, to the extent possible, we've added definitions to the new and existing categorical uses, and those will be in Chapter 17.110, which is where all of our other land use definitions are currently located. For uses like the transitory accommodations, we'll pull out the definitions that are in those chapters and integrate those into that section as well. So again, it's just a one-stop location for folks if they need to reference what some of the terminology means. Not to skip ahead too much, but you'll note in the table then down below, what we're proposing is actually adding a column on the right-hand side, which would then provide a section reference to that definition for the categorical uses. So anyone who is within the use table would be able to click a hyperlink and it would take them to that definition section in Title 17.110.
Well, I'm glad you're doing the overview here, because when I looked at this attachment, I thought you wanted us to fill this in for you. That was going to be a very long exercise.
No.
You'll get home earlier than that.
Yeah. Just trying to give you an understanding of the direction that we're headed in and validate that direction. Right.
And those hyperlinks would go both ways.
Correct, yes.
Okay, so if I look up a definition of a use, mm-hmm. then it will take me to the corresponding code.
That's actually, I'm going to retract on my, yes, we will do that, but.
We
would need to just figure out the mechanics of that, going back and forth right. between the two. But at the very least, you would be able to be within the table, click to get to that definition very right. quickly.
Could open a new window.
Yeah, that's true.
Depending on how code publishing sets it up.
Right.
Just open the right. the yeah. standard little pod.
Right.
Right.
Yep. Could definitely look into some language that then would allow us to reflect back to the use table.
Correct.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Code publishing provides a lot of hyperlinking services that right yeah. now we're barely tapping.
Right.
As, and I assume you're utilizing a contract service that helps do the linking and
yeah.
understands
yeah,
that.
Yeah. So right. so when an ordinance is passed, we ship the ordinance over to Code Publishing, which is the name of the company that provides the service, and they are the folks that go and they review it, they scrub it, they catch any inconsistencies and cross-referencing and things like that. They'll come back to us with questions, usually. Sometimes on a simple ordinance, they may only have one question or none. On something that's complex like this, they will catch any mistakes that we leave behind. And then they are the people that plug it into the format that you currently see on the county's website. And they can do any kind of cross-linking, hyperlinking, cross-referencing. They have quite a few services that
don't use. Some of them are snazzy things that we don't pay for, but some of them are just ones that we are paying for right now, but we just haven't taken advantage of them.
Okay. It would be very helpful to be in the definition section and be able to get to the use table.
Yes.
Where that definition resides. I think that'd be really helpful.
Mm-hmm. Then for the footnotes, what we're proposing right now is to actually create a chapter for categorical use development standards. So right now, some uses reference under the allowed use, so 17.410, 060 is special provisions applying to certain uses. And you go to that section and you'll find provisions for the ALQs and accessory dwelling units. Rather than lumping that all under the allowed use chapter, what we're proposing is to pull it out one level and have a standalone chapter that would lay out all specific standards by use. So, and I think it's probably easiest for us just to pull up an example of what this is going to look like. I'm going to grab the mouse here from Darren. So it would be a new chapter, which would start out with a purpose statement of that, and then you would have each of our categorical uses listed out. I'm going to scroll down here all the way to the next section here, where you'll start to see, so in order to encourage for accessory dwelling units detached, these are existing standards we have in code today. And what we're proposing is to actually take those footnotes that are linked to the use table and integrate them into this section based on categorical uses. So there's a number of footnotes that just relate to a specific use. So rather than having it, in the table, it would just stand alone in this one chapter.
So now you're creating a different area to look at.
So essentially, we're creating a different area to look at, but it's one area to look at instead of three different areas to look at. So right now, someone who wants to propose a dwelling, accessory dwelling unit, for example, they would have to take a look at where it's allowed. So you're looking at the use table. You're also looking at footnotes that may reference ADUs. So there'll be a number in that cell that would reference a footnote. So that's another section you have to go to. And then there may be special provisions, which for ADUs there are. So that's a third location you have to go to. In addition to all your parking and landscaping and other standards, with this kind of framework, you're only going to one location for those additional standards in terms of not landscaping and parking, but special provisions that apply to the land use itself. And this is pretty consistent to a lot of the different codes that we've reviewed across jurisdiction, as they've laid it out based on use versus having it kind of scattered as right. We do today.
Okay. So the wireless code and the marijuana regulations will remain as separate chapters. They wouldn't integrate into this.
So
section.
Right now, the marijuana regulations would be one that we would integrate into this section. The wireless code, we've had some internal discussions about that, and just based on how new it is, what we'll probably do in this section is reference that chapter until we've had a little more time. And that's consistent with how other jurisdictions typically do wireless telecommunication standards, is it's a standalone chapter.
Standalone chapter.
Yeah. But for
change that.
But for other types of uses, typically there's some sort of development standards chapter that's use-based.
Yeah, and this is very familiar from many codes that I've right. seen to have that set mm-hmm. up there.
Yeah.
And we've discussed leaving the ag code alone as well.
Yeah.
We would reference it from the table, but not, it wouldn't, we wouldn't be a separate section for that because it's kind of ingrained into other places. And it's relatively new as well.
And I will say there will be kind of a year of limbo here because, you know, there are footnotes that we have associated with the density and dimensions tables. So until we do a project where similar to this one with that frame of, you know, scope for an update, those footnotes are still going to live where they are today. We're not going to integrate those into this chapter with this project. So, you know, there's going to be a little bit of bouncing around until we can really refresh all of the different sections of our code and deal with the footnotes.
Rick, did you have something?
Yeah. So in addition, we're talking about development standards. We also have design standards. So I want to put a 6,000 square foot commercial building in Old Town. Mm-hmm. I've got the use table. Yeah. I'm going to still have setback issues in that in the footnotes.
Yep.
Currently, I'll have a section I can go through on development standards for commercial, mm-hmm. and then design standards I'll just have to find. Is that, or will that be linked in there as well?
So what we're proposing related to design standards, because there's a number of zones that have applicable design standards. So within the zone chapter itself, you'll also see some integration of those footnotes that reference design standards. So right now, it references you to the design standards tables, where we would actually then reference in here the Silverdale design standards, and that would be appendix, you know, whatever, because that's part of the clarifying edits we're doing this year is actually codifying those design standards from past planning processes so that they're actually in code and we can reference them and hyperlink back and forth.
And so again, where we have design standard that no longer matches up with the code.
Mm-hmm.
So West Hill, Silverdale, perfect example. No longer mixed use. Design standard is still for a mixed use.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to hyperlink to West Hill saying here's the design standard, six-story building. And when you come down to DCD for my application to do my little duplex, you'll say, oh, yeah, don't worry about that. Is that the way it happens?
I would have to read the Silverdale design standards, but I think it would be whichever is the most restrictive would apply. It's typically how it's structured. So in that case, it would fall to the underlying zone requirements if the design standards no longer apply.
Yeah. So again, that's my when I just hate these design standards. Again, you've got them hanging out there. We just put them into our comp plan, and they're completely irrelevant. Because there is no mixed use zone.
We recognize we have an issue there.
Yep.
So again, as a person coming to DCD, the response will be, yeah, the design standard's out of date. So although it says the code, you got to meet that. No, you really don't.
In that particular instance, it's going to have to be, I think that's going to have to be a conversation until such time that those design standards can be updated.
Well,
if we can identify an interim measure, you know, without having to rehash everything all simultaneously, and then we'll be here 10 years, we have to figure something out on that. We recognize that that's an issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, another discussion. The Rigoth Roundy for Silverdale was based in part on the densities associated with that development.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, we've got this horrible thing where the numbers in terms of what's approved and the numbers don't match. So, another day. All
right.
So, perhaps a suspension of design standards should be considered. Because when you think about it, if you're going to lay out a design and dictate to somebody how they're going to do something, you are now shutting off opportunities of people that have different ideas. And it seems kind of, you know, in the spirit of trying to encourage development, encourage, you know, building and progress, to set a design standard that is restrictive goes in the wrong direction. I mean, and it as we've seen, it sets up a conflict when things don't go the way the designer thought they should go.
Mm-hmm. Just
And then we talked about the zone standards a little bit. So there is, you know, underneath this, each zone chapter, we have a special provisions section. Right now, most of them just say reserved. So those are where we can pick up things like the design standards and other other footnotes that are just applicable to the zone itself. And then just to kind of finalize the actual table layout, so you'll notice we're doing a little bit of categorizing beyond the traditional or the existing categorization of that exists today in the use table. So right now we just number our uses. They're in there alphabetically. What we're proposing is to actually develop headings for similar type uses. So for accessory units, we would list the three categories that would fall under that. For dwellings, we would show them all. Instead of having dwelling existing, dwelling duplex, they would be bucketed under that category, and then you'd have your level of permit review split out here. Bed and breakfast, short-term vacation rentals, so you can see the scaling a little more clearly, and then other residential uses.
Why are the numbers only even numbers?
That's a great question. That's how it's always been in our code, and so we just are following form, providing, you know, an opportunity to slip in another use in case we identify one in the future.
Okay, I've so you don't never have to noticed that before.
Renumber.
It's leaving space for growth.
Exactly. And so, and again, noting at the top here, you have zone standards, which will be hyperlinked to those special provision sections of the zone, your definitions, and then those use standards that we talked about as well. So it's just another way to get to all the information you need from that table and kind of vice versa.
And so areas where we still have the footnotes, it'll be the way we have it before, 118, multifamily, parent 22, parent mm-hmm.
Correct.
39.
Exactly.
Yep. Yeah, ideally the intent here is between this update and next year's update of the dimensity and dimensions table, we do away with all footnotes that have some sort of a requirement in them. If we have any left, they should only be footnotes that are clarifying something in the table. And that's if we have any left.
We're getting close. All right. So if there's no other questions or concerns about the kind of migration or that framework that we're looking at, I'll move on to attachment 3, which is our revised project schedule. So we are slightly behind our initial schedule. We were anticipating in September we would be back out in the community doing some workshops and refinement of the initial draft proposal. We are now pushing that out to November and December timeframe. So we're currently in the process of scheduling those events, and there'll be some public communication blasts related to that. We'll be meeting with the vast majority of the stakeholder groups we met with early on in the process to provide awareness and promote the survey that was distributed. And we're looking at doing a couple of workshop sessions with some more frequent users of the code to help refine, and then also some community open houses. So individuals who are interested in this project can kind of see how this impacts, the changes might impact their neighborhood, and provide some early comment on the proposed changes prior to entering the kind of more formal public process and public hearings that'll happen. During the month of December and January, we'll be doing our department analysis. So we'll prepare the staff report, SEPA review, and then open the public comment period formally for the public process based on the department recommendation. And then in January and February, we'll be back here for a couple of additional work study sessions so that you can see kind of what has changed since we were here now. And then we're looking at a open house prior to the public hearing in mid-February with the Planning Commission. Hoping that final recommendation and findings would occur in March and April of 2020. And then working with the board for an open house and public hearing in April. And then their formal adoption in June. We're still working internally to identify the effective date of the ordinance because there will be quite a bit of training that goes into the changes that are being proposed both internally and externally. So, you know, a lot of times our ordinances take effect immediately. This may be one where we want to delay that effective date, you know, by a couple of months to allow for additional training prior to it actually taking effect. But we're still kind of scheduling all of that out internally, and the actual changes will really dictate that implementation period. My question to the commission is, are you comfortable with us coming back in January with these changes, or do you see a need for a check-in prior to that? We haven't really gotten into a lot of detail on the development standards for some of these new uses. Which is something that I think, you know, the commission may be interested in having some, you know, more meaty discussions on. But I just wanted to kind of gauge your level of interest and if you feel the two work study sessions that we have currently planned is sufficient to come up to speed prior to a public hearing.
Well, I'll look to Mr. Ward and others to tell us how busy we're going to be between now and January. First off, because I know we've had some things that have slipped and we may have a little more time than we had anticipated on our docket.
The only other big thing is going to be the comprehensive plan amendments, and that the schedule is slipping on that, so we're looking at adoption by the board of that in January now, probably late January. So that does slide things a little bit. I'm not sensing that there are going to be any other big ticket items that are going to eat up a lot of the commission's time beyond those two. And we've already, you know, over the past month, we've already initially had planned to have the two of them back to back during the same meetings. So I don't think we'd see any more impact than that.
Okay. Because if you are going to develop development standards for these new uses, we'd sure like to have a look at them before they go live. That would be great. And also, when you do come back in January, if you could give us a red line or a crosswalk of, you know, what we've just all been living with now and the changes that are being precipitated by the public input that you're receiving, that'd be helpful.
Okay. Yeah, I definitely see the summary of changes document being a living document that will carry throughout this project. And then the level of permit review, that's one where, you know, we can highlight some changes of, you know, the most significant shifts that we've seen based on public feedback and refinement.
Yep, that would be very helpful.
Okay.
Kind of jumpstart our discussions.
Yeah.
And we're having to track that anyway because we know we're going to have to be training our internal staff on all this stuff, so we need, you know, we're going to be developing, you know, these tables that are showing the changes and what's consolidated and what's been split apart. You know, we're going to have to build keys for everybody, so that way, as everybody's doing reviews, and then as all of our external customers, you know, are planning, you know, everybody's planning to what the target is today. So we're going to have to be able to crosswalk what's new in the code. So. I've always, when I was on the private sector side of it, I always appreciated a good key to tell me what's changed.
That's key to a successful transition.
Agreed. Well, it seems that you're going to have a lot of work on your hands. Good luck if you go forward. Does anyone else have any questions on the schedule or any requests of staff in between?
Well, I'll just add that I think you've done a fantastic job to this point, so I'm looking forward to the next several months.
Yeah.
You're here.
Yeah. And, you know, going back to the question, to the issue of the design standards that we talked about, you know, we recognize that that's an issue. We recognize that there are other inconsistencies in the code. You know, one of the approaches that we did seriously consider was what does it take to do an overhaul? And, you know, we looked at a complete overhaul. Yeah. So, you know, one of the more informational pieces was when we had a conversation with our counterparts at Snohomish County, who had gone through a unified development code process, you know, and completely redid everything. And after 10 years and more than $2 million worth of consultant time invested in it, they were pretty much uniform in saying we would never, ever do it again. It was not worthwhile. And because it was just, it took forever, and it was a big headache, and it was expensive. And so we're trying to figure out a way to do it stepwise rather than bite it off all at once. I'm sorry.
No, we're doing things on the design standards in two areas, a comp plan amendment, and now we're also integrating into here. And you say, oh, gosh, we're integrating law that is nonsense. It's no good. No, but here, we're doing it at the use table. I don't know what we're going to tell people when they come in. You know, you got to use the most restrictive for something that doesn't make sense. We, all the time, when we're doing either a comp plan amendment or this kind of code, say, wait a minute, there's a little thing we can do to fix it. West Hill. The design standard for West Hill is suspended. Why can't we have a, as part of either the comp plan process or this process, the commissioners say, wait a minute, we don't want to put into the code something we know we don't want, and it doesn't make any sense. So couldn't we, instead of doing the big overhaul, simply recognize this piece of the design standard doesn't work, let's suspend it.
Yep. I think that's a reasonable path to explore.
Yeah.
You know, I personally wouldn't be able to. I don't feel equipped right now to be able to say, yes, that's a brilliant idea. I'm just
looking for some kind of solution rather than say, yeah, we're adopting comp plan, we're adopting in the use table. It's nonsense. We don't know what to tell you, developer. You right. Got it. You figure it out.
I appreciate the suggestion.
Yeah.
I think that's a good suggestion.
Rich, is that a conversation you should be having with the Central District County Commissioner, perhaps?
Again, I'm happy to.
Have you?
Again, I would hope that, again, the staff would have some thoughts on it.
I think we can start looking into it, yeah. You know, as part of this process.
Well, because the design standards are not integrated into the code as yet.
They are, actually.
They are? Okay.
Yeah, they are codified in code.
Does it say suspended across the?
No. It just says come to DCD if you want a copy of them. What we were trying to do with the clarifying edits was just provide them to our customers and have them be readily available. So they are codified in code today. They live there. It was just an attempt to provide a more readily available version of the existing design standards.
It was only recently that we realized that only Silverdale was actually published on the website,
right?
Up until now. Now we've got them all up there. But when we discovered that, we looked at it and said, well, that's silly. You have design standards, but you can't find them anywhere. Right. That doesn't make any sense either.
Well, sometimes it's challenging when you codify sub-area design standards. You end up with this, where you face enormous process to roll with the changes.
Exactly.
That are on the ground, as opposed to having them be a standalone, you know, more of an advisory document to the staff that staff could change without going through the legislative process.
Right.
I just recommend that perhaps as a more agile way to handle the sub area design standards. I know you don't have too many of those, you know, but
Silverdale does.
Riverdale, Kingston.
Yeah.
Manchester,
okay.
Keyport, Ilocke.
They add up.
Well, you know, and I guess, you know, having had some experience over in Redmond where they would do, they had a neighborhood planning process that was scheduled for every 5 years. Mm-hmm. And so those design standards, you know, hit the planning commission and actually not the planning commission, but they had a commission that got formed for that mm-hmm. neighborhood to vet. And, but it was easier to change them without, when they weren't necessarily codified. Mm-hmm. It's just another approach mm-hmm. that gives staff more agility to make some changes.
Okay, thank you.
Right. Thank you so very much. Is there anything else on this?
And just with all that, I would join Mike in saying, you know, there's this frustration, but great job, again, looking at what you've done. Really good work.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, returning to our agenda, because this is a special meeting, we do not have an administrative update for this evening.
Of course you do.
So we'll move right to item G, which is anything else for the good of the order?
Well, it'll be administrative update. Have they hired the assistant directors yet?
I have nothing to report on that.
Okay.
I've been told very soon.
Okay.
All right. Anything else?
Now, we're going through the Growth Management Act update. Somebody is.
Are you referring to the Ruckelshaus Center study? That was...
No. I'm hearing proposals to our... on the growth management change or
in Olympia?
No.
I'm sorry.
Comp plan amendment comp plan. Process.
Thank you. Yeah.
Comp plan.
Yep. 2108.
Yeah. Right. So there are things going on with that now.
Yes, the board did adopt a final docket back in April. I believe it was late April. And staff is processing we have one site-specific application and then several others that are county-sponsored amendments. And we're behind schedule on that for a lot of reasons. So we were, according to our original schedule, supposed to have that in front of all of you right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so that schedule is still slipping. And that's why I mentioned earlier that we're looking at board adoption of that in probably late January at this point.
This is not the major update year, though.
No.
When is that coming up? When's
no,
the next one?
The next one is currently scheduled for 2024. Okay. The depending on what comes out of the legislature this year, that could slide because there has been discussion of changing it to a time that potentially aligns the PSRC counties, and there's also been discussion about trying to align it better with the census. The sweet spot for that seems to be would put us on a 2025 schedule, and that's what the county has been advocating for. Last session there were at least two, and I think there may have been a third that we're looking at alternative schedules. I know there was one that put all of the counties on the same schedule, which I suspect the Department of Commerce might have had something to say about that because that means that they're reviewing them all simultaneously. So there's always the potential that it could slip a year. And with the Ruckelshaus report coming out and recommending a better alignment of those, that puts a little bit more weight behind that recommendation. Go ahead.
More of my concern is what we're doing now, the comp plan revisions that are being proposed, which the current one, which Mr. Anderson brought to our attention today, I was unaware of that. I feel I'm backing up to a few years ago when we were going through comp plan proposals, and one of the commissioners was quite upset about how did we make these choices? How did these choices get here? And it was put before the planning commission, not as a choice or whatever, but just here's what we're going to do. And it kind of, I don't know, leaves us in the dark.
Well, I think if we want to change the way the Planning Commission is engaging in that discussion, that's something that we need to rewind all the way back to the beginning of the process as we're thinking through how we move forward.
Well, I thought it was. I thought we had proposed that was the plan was to bring these things forward and brief us on them, you know, and allow us to know how those decisions are being made.
As I recall, did we not do a briefing with the Planning Commission at the time of the final docket?
I believe you did.
I think so, because in our binder packet we have all the site specifics in there.
Right. Mm-hmm. I must have missed that.
I thought we did.
Okay.
Yeah, we did.
At that time. So there's the initial docket which in this current cycle came up in, when was that first brought in? December, I think it was.
December, yeah.
That was when we went to the board. November, December. Board adopts the initial docket. Then we take in whatever applications for whatever site specifics may be allowed or not allowed, you know, or if they're not allowed, mm-hmm. then we don't take them. And then we go through a little more, we process them a little bit to see where we are. Then we go back to the board, have another discussion, and then in April the board adopts a final docket. And then that's what we move with for the rest of the year. And that's where we are right now. Because of some of the workload attached to that, the schedule has now slipped.
Okay.
So we're kind of where we were last year with about a month of slide at this point.
We did get a flyby on that. We did get
We were looking at the mapping as well.
I thought we did.
Yeah.
And it's possible maybe it's a day when you weren't here. That's a possibility. Yeah. I'm speculating, of course, but one thing that we might want to think about is if there's a different way for this commission to engage in that process. We are part of this year's updates is a revision to Title 2108, which is how we're calendaring all these comprehensive plan updates, because right now we have a process that's substantially different than the way most of our neighboring counties do it. We don't have a prescribed schedule. There's a little bit of a free-for-all when the docket is developed. And it makes it hard to plan our staffing. That's been a real struggle for the department, is figuring out how do we staff what is essentially a moving target with a lot of workload attached to it. And that's why this year's adoption has slipped.
Yeah, the scheduling feature provides a bit of a stack ranking for staff as to, you know, which items, you know, are going to go Q1, Q2, Q3.
Right.
You know, we found that to be, I mean, that's helpful to know, you know, as a deliberative body, you know, for the board, you know, to know when it's coming forward, but it also informs staff about how to rank order that work
right.
as well. And it also gives the stakeholders some sort of certainty as to when their item is coming forward and when they can provide input. So I don't know if there's a deliberate choice not to dock it that way in the county or...
I can only speculate as to the origins of how we got where we are. I know it's been a real challenge for staff. We do go above we do have a lot of additive procedure that goes above and beyond what is required in the GMA and in state statute. So we would like to streamline it a little bit more. We would also like to, in that 8-year cycle, assuming it stays an 8-year cycle, doesn't change to a 10-year cycle or something else, within that cycle, we want to get more predictable about what will be accepted for consideration. Right now, the only thing that in Kitsap County that we have is a comprehensive plan policy that talks about a midpoint review. And that midpoint review, if we were to do it, was scheduled for 2020. This comp plan was adopted in 2016. Next update is 2024, so that midpoint is 2020. In conversations with the board about our staffing levels and our ability to keep the docket moving and to do a more intensive review at the midpoint, The board concluded that we really don't need to go there right now because it's just going to be really hard to staff it. We haven't even been able to gear up for it at this point. So, and that's part of the discussion that's coming up in the budget too, because the department does have a request for additional planning staff as well. So, ideally, where we would like to go is have a regular schedule. So we're saying we adopt the new comprehensive plan. 2 years later, we do this. 2 years later, we do this. 2 years later, we do this, and then we start going into the next update. The next big update, so that way the department can plan for its resource needs. All of our customers and the development community and everybody else can actually have a target at which they can say, okay, well, I know in my planning for this particular project, I need to aim for this year's docket. And I want to have my materials ready for this year's docket, as opposed to the current situation is, well, maybe I'm on, maybe I'm not. I don't know.
Right. So you did have an administrative update. Wow.
Now, I think that would be extremely helpful because I know a lot of users. It's been a source of contention quite a few times over the years about the scheduling. So if there were something more concrete, I think not only would it help users, you know, administratively, help the department.
And again, my report coming here was with Central Kitsap Community Council. And you guys are all not part of this history, but in 2016, there was a decision made by the county not to look at UGA expansions in Silverdale and others because we did not want to be invalid. We're going to be safe. We're going to do it right. So we downsized, got rid of mixed use. We didn't change any boundaries. We didn't look at design standards. Again, you look at it from the Silverdale community. Would any city do what we're doing now, saying we're going to adopt a comp plan, we're going to adopt use table, we're going to integrate code that is nonsense. We're going to do it. Would the city of Silverdale say, oh, we'll just leave that design standard on West Hill with the six-story buildings, even though the zoning only allows, you know, one unit per, you know, based on rural protect or urban protected. So when you look at it from the community's point of view and you see, geez, there's a groundswell to form a city, part of it is a result of what you're talking about. Don't have resources, don't have the ability to look at it. You know, hey, don't rock the boat. We don't want to be invalid. Silverdale, you're left with the numbers we had after we were invalid in the year 2010. Sorry. 2024, we'll look at your population again. We'll look at your boundaries. We'll look at your design standards when we can get to it. And so that's.
Can we put this on a parking? I think we identified a parking lot, a need for that as we go through this process. Can we put that on there and put it in a matrix form so we can keep track of these issues that need to go forward? Yeah. That'd be helpful, I think. Oh, and Joe, the comp plan materials are linked on the Planning Commission's electronic agenda for August 20th. So if you go to our website and scroll down to the August 20th meeting, those materials are there. Okay?
Thank you.
Yep. All right. Anything else for the good of the order? With that, we will adjourn. Thank you.